I'm Wayne Butler. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Keith for his hospitality. And I'll tell you what, it's a good thing we know we're human beings. No matter how we fudge things up, it all seems to come together. And I want to thank Keith for making contact with me. And I want to thank George for being at the airport for picking me up and making me feel at home and running me all around town and getting me set up in my hotel. And I want to thank the committee for allowing me to be here in Clancy's stead. It's an honor and a privilege for me to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous in any position of service. It humbles me to get to do something like this. 2 weeks ago, my sponsor called me and asked me what I was doing this weekend. And I said, you know what I'm doing this weekend. I'm going to be at the Southern California Convention. He said, well, that'd be a good idea. How about going to Ogden, Utah? And, of course, my mind drifted with the knowledge that I was going to have an escort, my sweetie, at the Southern California Convention. And my tickets were all paid for, and I had plans. Plans to have fun. And my mind said all that in a split second. My mouth said, okay. And I noticed that your mantra is the spirit of sponsorship. And I'll be mentioning sponsorship a lot in my talk, in part because it's probably one of the key elements of my life, is that I was able to submit myself to somebody else's way of life when I thought I had good ideas. And I know sponsorship is what turned my life around. I found my higher power through the sponsorship service, working with other alcoholics. I'll get into that in a minute. But I also want to... I found out my friend and AA brother, Bob D, duh for short, was going to be here this weekend. And I see he's got a set of tapes out there for some big book workshop he did a couple years ago. And I'll bet you he didn't tell you this story. And it's true. You might not know, but he was in prison at one time. And back in the old days, long ago, when you were sentenced to death, you may not know this. When you were sentenced to death, when they attempted to execute you, if the execution failed, you got to go free. It's really true. Well, Bob was on death row. See, they had this Catholic, Muslim, and alcoholic. And, of course, we know which one Bob was. And the guy that ran the prison was sadistic. And right there by the electric chair, he had this giant picture window, and he only did multiple executions. So everybody would have to watch their turn coming up. And the panel with the handle was right there by the window. And so they had Bob and the Catholic sitting there, and they brought the Muslim out, and they put him in a chair, and they shaved his head, put the cone over his head, and seat-belted him in and all that stuff. And the executioner says, son, you got any last words? And he says, yes, I do. As a matter of fact. He says, I'll be good, I'll be great. Get me out of this terrible fate. And the executioner went over, and Bob's staring at the handle. He pulls that handle down, and nothing happened. And they let him go free. The Catholic's in there praying, and Bob's staring at the box. They bring the Catholic out, and they set him in a chair, shave his head, put the cone over his head, belt him in, and the executioner says, you got any last words? He says, yes, I do. Hail Mary, full of grace. Rescue me from this terrible place. He pulls the handle down as Bob watches. Nothing happens. And they let him go. They bring Bob in, set him in the chair, put the cone over his head, belt him in. Executioner says, you got any last words? And he says, damn right I do, but first you better fix those wires hanging from that bar. I love AA. I love AA because I discovered something very, very simple. When I'm with you, I'm not with me. You hear me? Because when I'm not with you, I'm left with me. And I'm not alone. There should be a neighborhood watch sign right there. And there should be a guard at the back door, not worrying about nothing coming in, worrying about what might come out. If you're home in this room tonight, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous and to one of the most exciting events of my life, is to go to convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you about that. It's real humbling for me to be here in my sponsor's stead, and I'll tell you why. Almost 21 years ago, I was 3 weeks sober, and my sponsor took me to my first convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I came to AA, I'd been wearing the same clothes for about 3 months, and my sponsor thought I might need to do something about my appearance to meet these people. This was in Illinois, 2,000 miles from Southern California. So my sponsor takes me to the Salvation Army, and we go over to the suit section, and we buy me this lime green, double knit, double breasted polyester suit. The inside lining was yellow, and it had green tennis rackets. Then we went and found me a shirt, and I picked one out that I thought was silk, had little animals on it. Found out it was brushed polyester. Then he took me over to the underwear section, and I said, "No way, pal." Then I went over to the shoe department because I needed some shoes. Now remember this, this was 20 years ago. The only 13.5-inch gunboats they had, remember them black and brown box toe Oxford 4-inch platform hippie shoes with a 6-inch heel? That's all they had. So we bought them. We got out of the Salvation Army for $1.85. And he took me to this convention thing and stands me at the door. And these speakers come in. And as they greet my sponsor at that time, his name is Barney, as they greet my sponsor, they're very cordial and polite, and they utter niceties and, you know, all that crap. And then they turn to me, and before they can get my hand, they're laughing. They're looking me up and down and laughing. And finally, after the last one shook my hand and started laughing, I couldn't take it another minute. I looked at my sponsor. I said, "Barney, are they laughing at me?" He goes, "Yeah. Yeah, they are. You're a sight to behold, pal." Then he says, "You know what, dummy?" He says, "If you ever learn to laugh at yourself, you'll never be left unamused." His gut. You, I am living proof you do not got to like your sponsor. It took a long time, just 9 short years, to quit plotting his death. So I found out who these speakers were. I want to tell you who I got to sit with 3 weeks sober. There's a guy by the name of Chuck Chamberlain and a little lady named Elsa. And next to them was a guy named Dick Chamberlain, who had just gotten from Europe. And then there's another guy sitting next to him named Norm Alpe. Then a guy named Johnny H. And a guy named Clancy I. And a guy named Tom Brady from Charlotte, North Carolina. And a gal by the name of Dottie Shore. And I had a privilege that I didn't know I had of sitting at that table. And I got to tell you something. I didn't know it at the time. And if you're new in this room, I want you to hear me. It altered the course of my life. Because something was done to me, like Chuck C. used to say, at an unconscious level, that I couldn't comprehend, that affected me and made me want to be like them. They attracted me to A. Now, I thought Chuck C. was crazy as hell, if you want to know the truth. He talked about things that went way beyond my retarded capacity. But Clancy brought me right back in. It was like, man. I don't remember much about that weekend, but I do remember I wanted more. And I've been doing these conventions ever since. I can't get to enough of them because I love AA. I truly do. I hope, if you don't hear nothing else tonight, I want you to hear how much I love AA. Because AA has allowed me the opportunity to absolutely work my butt off. To uncover, discover, and discard those things about which me, that separate me from my loving Father God and from you. Allowed me to come into unity with the universe, so that I could have peace in my life. And for a guy like me, that's not supposed to happen. See, when I tell you now I'm an alcoholic, I didn't know what that meant. I had no idea. I've been diagnosed a lot. As a matter of fact, I've been diagnosed 17 times. I've been in 17 psychiatric institutions. And I really like it there. I really do. If you've been there, you understand. See, I'm going to tell you why. Some of you have heard me already. Those of you who haven't, you'll know in about an hour. When I was on the street, I couldn't get a date to save my life. But when I went to the psych ward, I had a 50-50 shot. I did. Now I'm going to tell you how to do it in case you slip. When you get to the psych ward, they line them up. They put the men over here and the women over there. And they bring the med cart right onto the floor. And I see them, and I know they're taking Thorazine. And I know what Thorazine does to you. I've had enough pumped into my butt to slow me down until I'm 260. Thorazine's an interesting thing. It doesn't do one single thing to slow my thinking down. But no matter how fast I think, my butt's only going like this. Well, if it does that to me, it's got to do it to her, too. So I tongue my Thorazine. Then I wait till the one I picked out of the litter takes hers. Then I time it, because I know in about an hour I'm going to get a date. Well, it works if you work it. But I was never diagnosed alcoholic. Isn't that an interesting thing? I've been diagnosed with a character disorder, personality disorder, paranoid schizophrenia, borderline personality defective character disorder stuff. My last diagnosis was a potential homicidal psychopath. I love that. There's a certain amount of esteem in that. My nickname was CW. There's Crazy Rain. People moved out of the way. But I could not comprehend in my mind that I'm an alcoholic because, number one, I don't know what one is and I don't know what one looks like because they can't give you a picture of what one looks like. Only you can say to me, I am an alcoholic, and then I get to see. And until that point in time, I don't get to be an alcoholic. Don't get to be an alcoholic until someone like Bob walks up to me and says, you know what, I know how you feel. I've been where you are. And then he tells me his story, and I have a picture of alcoholism that I can believe. And I submit to you, that's what affected me. That day I was sitting in that round table with those fine folks from AA 3 weeks sober, I had no idea that I was sitting in the movement of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea. I wish I would have known. I would have plucked their brains for anything I could have got out of them. Instead, in all of my arrogance, in all of my ego, I didn't need their help. Thank you. I'm doing just fine in my double knit green polyester suit. You see, just because I sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous does not indicate that I'm an alcoholic. Hear me? Just because I'm out in that room doesn't mean I even know what alcoholism is or that I'm suffering. It does not also indicate that I'm into the solution. It just realizes that I'm a mass of unrealized potential. And if I don't move from the position of potential to acceptance and correction, I'm hopeless. And I got to tell you, if you're new in this room, and perhaps if you're not new and you might need to be renewed, you know like I know what it feels like to be in this room and think I don't fit in. My God. And I didn't know. That's why I came to these meetings for 5 years and drank. I'll never forget it. I've been sleeping in the car for a while after the dumpsters got too cold. I'm a dumpster diver. I know I don't look like one. That's because I got my store-bought teeth in. By the way, if they come out, just throw them back. We are like men who have lost their teeth. We never grow new ones. I love Budweiser. I walked up 25th Street tonight, and I felt at home. I'm a beer drinker. Because we can't be alcoholic. I had some fine wine, too. Ripple. Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. You know what I like about Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill? Is when you throw up, it looks like you're bleeding internally. And then you add Mad Dog 2020 grape, and that'll get you right there. And I want to tell you what else it'll do to you. It'll give you a condition we know as ATD, Alcoholic Terminal Diarrhea. I had diarrhea so long it required split-second timing and good decision-making skills. I remember I was at Larry's Oasis one night, it was about 2 in the morning, and I saw her at the end of the bar. And I'm trying to get my courage up to move over there and talk to her, and I realized that I had to pass gas. So I made a critical decision, took action, which meant new meaning to the word shake a leg, and then I slid over, and she didn't want nothing to do with me. And so I went home to my wife, and, of course, I got to go through the ivory altar where she fears to tread. And I'm in there with Hamilton stamped right on my forehead, just puking for everything I'm worth, right? And all of a sudden, my denture blows out into the toilet. And it's a race between me and the hole at the bottom to catch him before I lose him forever. And I catch him just before they go down to shoot her. And I think, well, what the hell? I rinse him off and put him right back in. Boy, I sure miss drinking. I had no idea I was headed down that road, folks. I had no idea because, you see, at the age of 8, I wanted to pitch for the New York Yankees. I had a phenomenal ability to play baseball. I love baseball. I'd play it today if I could. But I've got a few problems, as you'll know soon. But I had a condition I didn't know I had, and I want to share it with you. Don't worry, I'm going to talk about drinking. You got to drink to be an alcoholic. Some people don't know that. It's like whenever I go out to 405 North out there past my place out in the valley out in Santa Monica area, there's a great big Anheuser-Busch distillery right there. Every time I go by there, I have a moment of silence. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's an opinion written by a guy by the name of Dr. Silkworth. We finally refer to him as Silky because of his contribution to Alcoholics Anonymous and his contribution to Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. He gives a set of symptoms in the doctor's opinion. It's further amplified upon in the 12 and 12 by Father Ed Dowling, Reverend Sam Shoemaker, and Dr. Harry Thibault. It's a collection of symptoms that sets me up for a condition known as alcoholism. And I submit to you the reason I'm here tonight is because I understand it, I believe it, I accept it, and I take action to correct it. And if you're new in this room, I want you to hear this. Maybe you won't identify. If you don't, go to another meeting, dismiss me completely. Do not judge AA because of me. I'll judge you, but don't judge AA because of me. According to Dr. Silkworth, Shoemaker, Father Ed Dowling, when I tell you I'm an alcoholic, here's what I'm really suggesting. I'm suggesting to you that I realize I look to you like I'm a full-grown adult male. Well, in reality, I remain childish, grandiose, and gravely, emotionally immature. As a growing human concern, my natural state is one of growing anxiety, depression, and fear, coupled with an intense desire for excitement, a condition which is complicated with and exacerbated by an obsessive, compulsive, impulsive, excessive, controlling, demanding need for everyone's attention, unqualified acceptance, and unconditional approval. As a result, I am restless, irritable, and discontent with life. Now, I had no idea I had just declared the major symptoms of an ism. You know what the ism is? You've heard a lot of acronyms for it. I like the one that's in the big book. And by the way, I got to get something off my chest. I hate people who come up to this podium, quote pages and paragraphs out of the book, seemingly to impress you and embarrass me by what I don't know. on page Roman numeral 24. Silkworth gives me a little hope for my future. He says, quote, "They are maladjusted to life and in full flight from reality and outright mental defectives." Thank you. "I suffer from what's known as an internal spiritual maladjustment. And it talks in the book that it affects my mental and emotional nature." In the big book, it says that. You might wonder how. So I'm going to tell you. "Mentally, my thought life is governed by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, all of which drive me to live my life according to selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, inconsiderate, resentment, frightened motives in life. Motives which, left unattended in me, arouse and engage dangerous and life-threatening," I said life-threatening, "levels of lust, pride, anger, envy, greed, sloth, gluttony. I turn into a pig. I want it all. That renders me emotionally a bit sensitive. Which means I have this strong tendency toward taking everything I see or hear personal. I don't like criticism. And I can't stand praise. I run away. When it comes to suffering emotionally, I don't like to suffer emotionally. I don't suffer well. And I don't suffer alone. Socially, I'm a bankrupt idealist and brooding perfectionist who lives defensively and guarded in fear of being found out. As such, I tend to rationalize, minimize, justify, and deny all my actions while casting blame upon innocent people in a vigorous attempt to avoid detection. Therefore, when it comes to my fellow man and woman, I demand, and I said demand, to possess and control everybody and every circumstance that enters my arena of life. Therefore, I am quick to anger, slow to virtue, and I get a distinct, succinct delight out of judging and criticizing everybody I see. My outstanding characteristic is defiance. And rebellion dogs my every step. Now, as a child of God, that's a catalog of my finer qualities. Anybody want a date? Now, that could also be misdiagnosed as intense neurosis. However, there's a significant difference between me and the neurotic. You give them Valium, they're fine. Not me. Now, for you newcomers, I'm going to simmer all those symptoms down to a quiet understanding that I hear at every meeting I go to. You're going to hear it at every meeting you've been to and ever going to go to. They come out like this, though. I don't fit in. I don't belong. I'm not a part of. What's wrong with me? I must be different. I would have never known that that was it. And when I feel like that, I have to do something to adjust myself to those feelings. And I do. That's part one. Now, I want to tell you what that did to me so that I can tell you why I drank. Because I'm one who knows why I drank. When I was 8 or 9 years old, those feelings were embowled in me. I was looking at my mirror at home. By the way, I come from an alcoholic home. I'm not going to tell you nothing about it because it's none of your business. And also because I hope some of them make it to AA, and I don't want them to have to live down anything I've told you. They should have the same free chance at recovery as I've got without having to live down any judgment for what I might tell you out of a victim position. And then maybe that'll get me a little forgiveness for what I did too. But if if you want a clue what my family was like, just tune in to about a week of Jerry Springer. Somewhere around 8 or 9 years old, I looked in my mirror at home and I had all these feelings I didn't understand. I remember saying to myself, Butler, it's too bad, pal. It's going to be a long life. And it's going to be lonely because you are butt ugly, pal. Now, I don't know where that came from. My mother did not sit me down and go like this. Oh. Poor little feller. Boy, just out of mercy, I'd put you back if I could. That's not what my mother said, but that's what I heard when she said, I love you. You hear me? My sponsor that I have today tells me I have a disease of perception. Boy, do I understand that clearly today. I took those feelings, didn't know what they felt. And I want to tell you something interesting about my type of an alcoholic. Because I feel different, I don't fit in, I don't belong, I'm not a part of, I'm constantly wondering what's wrong with me, I'm about to go out of my mind. So apparently I act out there the way I feel in here to keep from going insane. And it's interesting, I felt retarded. So I acted retarded. Now you know what will happen if you act retarded? They'll diagnose you. I was in ninth grade at school, and I was acting retarded, and I got diagnosed retarded. They put me in not the remedial class, not special ed, not ride the short bus, retarded class. And I quickly improved. And so they kept me there until I graduated high school. And I loved the retarded class. Boys could go to the girls' bathroom and not get detention. And there was a guy named Tom that felt sorry for us retarded kids. And he took us on field trips. There was 11 of us, but I used to lie and say 12 because it was kind of programmatic. Took us on field trips, and I was his favorite. I let him all know it every day. And I'm a senior now. And Tom decides to take me to a senior dance. Never been to one of them things before. I've had kind of a sheltered life. Had a lot of time to do some controlled thinking. Tom takes me to a senior party. I'm standing up against him. I want you to hear something. I went to that party 6'3", 320 pounds, feeling ugly and retarded with pimples everywhere, where nowhere. No, God didn't intend to put them. And I just feel bad about myself. And I don't know how to talk. My feet are so big, everybody's making fun of them. I'm afraid to move forward. So I leaned up against the wall. Tom brings me over to this long brown bottle with a red, white, and blue label. Had no idea I was about to fall in love. He said, here, drink this. It'll make you feel better. It was a Budweiser. And I drank it. And I said, Tom, that tastes terrible. I want a Pepsi Cola. He said something that still reverberates in my ear. He said, that's okay, kid. You'll get used to it. Now, to this very day, Tom is a friend of mine. He's not an alcoholic. Does not have a problem in his life related to anything like this. He just meant, like anybody else that starts drinking or smoking, or you got to get a little bit sick first to learn how to do it. And that's what he meant. But Silkworth talks in the big book about abnormal drinkers such as me drink essentially because I like the effect produced by alcohol. And that it's unusual. Chuck C. said it was unconscious. The cunning, baffling, powerful aspect of alcohol is that it affects me unconsciously. Therefore, I can't contain it, I can't control it, and I can't take care of it. I didn't know what all that meant until I came to you guys. But I can tell you what it meant to me that day. I experienced an effect like this. Somewhere between 4 and 5 Budweisers, I got so good looking I couldn't stand it. Things grew. I went from 6'3", 320 pounds to 6'3", 240 pounds, and I felt bulletproof. I gathered up everything I had and walked. I eyeballed me a blue-eyed blonde out on the dance floor. Never danced in my life. Walked right up to her and said, would you like to dance? I felt my pimples popping all by themselves. And she said, yes. And I fumbled my way through it. We found out later that night sex meant two people. I didn't know that. and she damn near ruined my sexual life forever. It was a bad experience. See, I've been having sex since I was 13, and damn it, I was good at it. And then apparently I lost my memory. We know what that is. That's a blackout. Tom told me the next day I had a great time, and I said, good. And I went back to the retarded class. A few weeks later, my dad called me in, said, pal, we got a problem. I said, yeah, what's that? And he said, you know what Greer's with at that party? I said, yes, sir. He said, she's 16. I said, okay. I mean, I'm thinking I'm retarded. What does it mean to me? He said, she's pregnant. Now, I could tell by the tone of his voice that wasn't good. You see, in the state of Illinois, they got this little law where any boy 14 or older has sex with a girl 17 or younger, whether she wants to or not, doesn't matter. It's called statutory rape. And I said, Dad, what's that mean? He says, 20 years to life. I said, even if you're retarded? Yeah. So I found out if you marry him, you don't go to jail. So I fell in love. We went to Palmyra, Missouri, where you can marry your 10-year-old cousin if you got enough money. Then appear on the Springer show. And we got married. I want you to picture this. We're on our way back from Missouri. Mom and Dad in the front seat, me and my wife Bonnie, baby in the belly in the back seat, and it occurs to me, well, this is interesting. I'm about to graduate the retarded class in high school. And I've only drank one time, folks. I can't wait till I do that again. And then the big book describes another circumstance where when the heat's on, the pressure's on, I seem to get geographical. Hell, even Utah looks good to me. Well, my brother's in a place called the Navy and a place called the Gulf of Tonkin, Vietnam. Now, he wrote letters back of how much fun he had fishing off the ship and everything. And I thought, wow, he's fishing, I'm in trouble, think I'll go fishing. So I asked my dad if I could join the Navy. My dad looked me right in the eye and he said, well, I don't know if they'll take a retarded kid, but let's go see. So he took me to the recruiter. I took the naval entrance exam, and I scored in the upper 3rd percentile, United States Navy. Don't you find that interesting? But the recruiter was really concerned about the retarded thing. So he made me enlist in the reserves so that I could graduate with my class. So just before I turned 18, I decided to drink for the second time. Now, Silkworth says in the doctor's opinion that we experience strange mental twists preceding a relapse into drinking. I went to this party and I saw Budweiser and didn't drink a drop because I don't want no more babies. And I saw this big quart bottle with clear liquid in it called tequila. Well, I ain't never had tequila before, so I drank the whole bottle. Tom says to me, you better watch out, that stuff will come back to haunt you. Well, I know what he meant by that now. It means I'm going to have a face-to-face talk with God. And I did. God sat right on my lap, and I talked to him in person. By the way, do not tell a psychiatrist you talk to God in person. Because you ain't getting out until you produce him. So I told God everything that I thought my family did to me in that alcoholic home growing up that I wanted to get even for, and I asked God what he thought I ought to do. I heard God tell me to go home and kill my family. So apparently I went to my mother's house in the middle of the night, blew all the pilot lights out on all the gas products, turned all the gas back on, left the house and passed out on the porch. I came to that morning somewhere between 5 and 6 a.m. with my mother kicking me in the head. My mother wasn't mad. My mother was frantic. She had a terrible headache and stomach ache from the gas fumes. She thought I was dead. The reason they didn't die is because I forgot to close the windows. So they took me to the doctor. And the psychiatrist interviewed me. 7 of them. And I took a test called the MMPI. Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. Found out I have a lot of personality. Never been accused of not having personality. Then I took a test called the Cal State Poly, and I took an ink blot test. That's my favorite. What's that look like? Your mother. That's your father there, too. And they diagnosed me. I get diagnosed a lot. Now, I'm in this room when my mom and dad are called in. I'm in a straight jacket in a chair, and they're talking to my mom and dad. And this doctor says to my mother very sincerely, Mrs. Butler, we can't release your son. We've tested him. We're of the collective opinion that he's an untreatable psychopath at this point in his life. He has no conscience, no remorse, no guilt, and no shame. He does not have the capacity to feel or extend love. We collectively believe if we release him, he will probably kill you or do great harm to other people. There's a little future hope for you. And then my mother saved me. She says, you can't keep him. He's in the Navy. Now, you might wonder why that paid off. Because this was 1968. Vietnam was going full force. And this doctor thought for a while, and he looked at my mother, and he says, you know what? There might be a place where we could use someone like him. I found myself in Vietnam in less than 90 days. And I was gone 3 years. I'm not going to go into all that stuff, but I will tell you this. I never drank a drop while I was gone. Those first 2 times scared the hell out of me. I mean, first time I drank, I got a girl pregnant, damn near went to prison for the rest of my life. Second time I drank, almost killed the family I've got. Can't wait for the 3rd try. So I didn't drink a drop. And for 3 years, I didn't do any drugs in Southeast Asia. And I saw a lot of my friends doing drugs, and the reason I didn't do them is because they were getting killed because they were loaded. I could figure that out. So for 3 years, I just went on the nap. Would put a definite spin on my personality. I came back 3 years later. I'm now 21 years old. I've been decorated for bravery. I'm playing baseball for the 7th Fleet in San Diego. I'm captain's driver. I've got watchstanders liberty, and my life is good. You see, if I know what I got to do, when I got to do it, and how I got to do it, I operate real good. One day, the captain asked me to babysit his kids, and I'm going to tell you something. I honor and respect my captain just like I do my sponsor. I would do anything he asked me to do. And he asked me to babysit his kids, and I said, yes, sir. I went and got the ship's company car and was headed toward his house, and from nowhere I started talking to myself. Here's what I said. Wayne, let's stop and get a six-pack of Bud. What the hell? What can it hurt? We haven't drank for 3 years, and prior to that we only drank twice, and nothing really bad happened. So I stopped and got a six-pack of Bud. And then I remember putting his kids in the car to go get another six-pack. And that's all I remember. I blacked out again. And I came out of that blackout with my captain 2 inches from my face, screaming, where's my kid? I didn't know. Now, apparently, during my blackout, I had taken him to his sister's house and dropped him off for good care. And I tried to explain that to the captain after we found out that I, even though my intentions were a little off, I did do the right thing. And he was absolutely appalled at me. And I want you to know something. When I know someone has respect for me, I can see it when they lose it. And I lost his respect. I didn't know that that was important to me. And he told me I had to go to treatment for chronic alcoholism. And I said, what? I said, I ain't. Got a lot of mental problems. You know, you took me. But I ain't no alcoholic. And you know, they discharged me. honorably, but it's always been tattooed in my head why I got discharged. And you know what? I was married to that first wife. We got divorced. I got married to my second wife. We produced a couple more kids. And the insanity of alcohol and alcoholism was on me. I had no idea what I was chasing, folks. I had no idea. I had no idea what was wrong with me. I was absolutely powerless to do anything about it. It wasn't a case of willpower at that point. It was a case of, what do I do? I submit to you, if I don't know what's wrong, I can't fix it. And if I don't know what's wrong, I can't let you help me fix it. I'm absolutely and totally, completely powerless. And my second wife and I were doing the dance of death. I want to tell you what sent me out to the streets into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went on a three-day drunk. She sent me out for milk. By the time I got home, it turned to cottage cheese. Kind of curdled. And you know, I always come home at 2 a.m. for some reason. Drunk. Usually having been in a blackout, not knowing where I've been, and my wife wants to know where I've been. Now it's going on to 3 a.m. and we're fighting. And we're on the floor rolling around acting stupid. And we wake my two daughters up, and they come down, and I remember my one daughter grabbed my leg trying to protect her mother. And the full force of the insanity of alcoholism in a family was on at that precise moment in time. And then I had an out-of-body experience. I saw myself put my wife down to the floor, put a .357 to her head, and I pulled the trigger. And I want you to know something. I will never forget in my mind's eye that hollow look in my two daughters' face and the shock that was in their face. It all happened in just frames of split seconds. And then I realized the gun didn't go off. Gun misfired. Shouldn't have. Wasn't nothing wrong with it. Still got that bullet at home. I've never thrown it away. It's a .357 hollow point. It's got the firing pin indented, center mass in the cap. It just didn't go off. She left me anyway. By the way, if you're judging me right now, I don't blame you a bit. I'm worthy of judgment. However, I must caution you that if you're judging me, then you're beginning to ease your way out of AA. There is no judgment here. We all live in glass houses. A great man once said, "Let he who has not sinned cast the first stone." I'm not asking you to excuse me. I'm asking you to understand and accept me as I am. And Alcoholics Anonymous has done just that. But now I've got to tell you the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Al-Anon family group. Because we need them to put families like mine back together again. She left. Big, rough, tough guy, me, sat by the front door in the fetal position and bawled like a baby for 3 days. And I started making deals with God right out of the third chapter. I said, "God, if you bring her back, I'll sell my gun." "God, if you bring her back, I'll sell all my guns." And then I went for the big one, the fail proof. "God, if you bring him back, I'll get a job." And 3 days later, there's a knock on my door. I want to tell you something about the blessed gift of desperation. When I work with an alcoholic, I do absolutely nothing to relieve them of their desperation. Nothing. Because I know that that is the only motivating force for an alcoholic like me to do what we ask him to do here in AA. And I remember that day she came back, and I remember I opened the door and she looked me in the eye and she says, "Can we come home?" And in the blink of an eye, something came over me. And I looked at her and I said, "Well, I don't know. You hurt me when you left." "You promised never to abandon me again. You can come home." Yeah. She came home. We need the Al-Anon family groups. We need them. I'm grateful that we have them at our side. And that brought me to AA because I couldn't take it. I didn't know I had a little sliver of decency left in me. I didn't know that. But I saw that if I stayed, something terrible was going to happen because I'm powerless. I cannot do anything about what's going on. You see, the earth people can't comprehend that, so they have to judge me. But when I come here, you know, because you've been where I've been. You understand how I feel. Because have you ever drove drunk with your kids in the car? Have you ever drank while you were pregnant? I mean, let's not judge each other. Let's reach out and carry the message to each other. And that allowed me to be here with you. It allows me to be here with you tonight. And I left. And that's when I started living in a dumpster, because that's the only place I had to go. And it got too cold, so I stayed in the car. My car was parked out behind Harvey's restaurant in Moline, Illinois. Never forget it. And this little kindly midnight waitress took pity on me, because I would come in and ask for a cup of hot water. And I would take tomato ketchup and pour it in the hot water and stir it and make a little bit of soup out of it. And I would go around back and get the saltines that she had snuck into the garbage can for me. And that's what I ate. One night she asked me, she cut me a deal. She said, if you'll mop and wax the dining room floors, I'll give you 2 sausage sandwiches on whole wheat toast. I thought that was underpaid. And I did it anyway. One night the owner came in and caught me. Name's Harvey. Stands about that tall, but ugly. He's got this giant nose that looks like bombs have landed on it. And just underneath the skin, you can see these red and purple blood veins pulsating with his heart. And he pulls his coin out of his pocket. And he shook my hand. Shook my hand. A bum. And he gave me that coin. It had 2 A's on it. Then on the back it had a prayer. And he said, I'm going to send you to see some friends of mine. They're going to help you. Now, I'm grateful I have a disease of perception, because that's not what I heard. Here's what I heard. We understand you're hungry. They'll give you some free food to eat. We know you're broken homeless, so we'll give you some pocket dough. And 3 or 4 packs of Pall Mall tailor-made cigarettes. That's the only reason I went to 416 16th Street that next day. Now, I want you to picture this. I find the address, and on the side of the building is a sign posted by the city municipality. It says, building condemned. Do not enter. Right below it was another sign with an arrow pointing into the basement. The basement windows, of course, the basement. The basement windows were painted black. I couldn't see in there. And they couldn't see out. Found out later that was anonymity. And there was a light bulb hanging on a cord, flickering on and off from a short in it. And he told me, if the light's on, go in. They're expecting you. I had to go get a drink. I come back, and I go charging through that door, because that's how I do life. And I failed to notice the doorway of the basement was 5'10". I'm 6'3". Caught it smack across the eyebrow, and the impact literally knocked me off my feet, and I slid into my first meet at Valley College Mountain. Inside that cellar door, about 6 feet, was this round table with 6 or 7 old farts waiting to die. That was my opinion later. And they always had round tables. One day I said, why are there round tables? They said, it's so the devil can't corner you. See, they'll mess with the newcomer because they ain't got a damn thing else to do. See, we're just cannon fodder for the old timers. And I slid between 2 of them old crusty deacons, and this old ugly one got up out of his chair and went just like this. Then he said, slide right in here, dummy. We got a wrench to fit every nut that comes in the door. I didn't like him right away. So I started reaching for that .357 I had down by my ankle. And just before I got my hand on the butt of that gun, he said what saved his life. He says, dummy, I'm going to be your sponsor. Now, you might wonder why that saved his life, since I've never been to AA before. I played baseball. Sponsors pay for everything. I got up off that floor and promptly stuck my head right up his butt. They say Barney needed turn signals on his hips to keep him breaking my neck should he turn left or right too sudden. And I followed him around for the next 5 years and drank every day. Drank before meetings, drank after meetings, sometimes drank during meetings. If you're new in this room and you're drinking, you keep on coming back. You're welcome here with us. If we ever find a group of Alcoholics Anonymous where a drinking drunk ain't welcome to sit and pay attention, that's not AA. In my opinion, that's a gathering of people who forgot from whence they came. However, we do want you to behave while you're here. That's the problem. See, in my case, I can either drink or I can behave. I just can't do them simultaneously. And I remember when I came into my home group and I'd been drinking, and I was a little bit loud, and one of them old timers says, "You got to quiet down." And something, anytime an authority figure comes into my face, something happens. I'm powerless. He says, "You got to quiet down." I looked around and I said, "I don't want to." Another old timer looks at me and he says, you got to sit down. You got to take a seat." And I said, "I don't have to." And then another one says, "You know what? You're welcome here, but you got to leave." They talk funny here. "You can come back tomorrow if you can act right." And I looked at him and I said, "You can't make me." "Yeah, they can." Four guys about your size. Each one grabbed an arm and a leg, talked a goofy newcomer into holding the door open. I noticed as I flew by. And just before I landed in 16th Street, I heard one of the old timers yell out, "Keep coming back." Then about 4.5 years drinking, going to meetings, I came into a meeting one night and I heard my sponsor yell out, "Hey, dummy." He says, "This program tends to work better if you don't drink." I never heard that. Not for 4.5 years. And that bothered me. So I reached down into my boot, grabbed that .357, reeled around and fired a round off of his face and missed him 6 inches high. There's a standing joke at my home group in Illinois. Barney would have been 6 foot tall, he'd be 6 foot under. That was my 17th trip to the psych ward. I came to at Franciscan Mental Health in Rock Island, Illinois, strapped to a steel bed and 6-point leather restraints in a padded room, naked, with black and blue from head to toe from little AA group therapy. They did it with love. I had a visitor that morning. You know who it was? Oh, I couldn't get rid of him for nothing. He was like a maggot on a bad piece of meat. He looks down at me, "Dunny, there's something wrong with you. I don't even know if you're an alcoholic. You might just be nuts." And I'm laying there thinking, "They got to let me out of here sometime, pal." And like he read my mind. "Don't know if they're going to let you out of here." "They're talking about keeping you and studying you a while." And then he said what I'll never forget. He said, "But you know what, dummy? Now, if you're in therapy, don't be offended." Okay. He said, "If they let you out, if you come with us and do what we did and still do, you can recover too." No judgment. Never said a word about what I'd done the night before. That's Alcoholics Anonymous, my friend. I didn't stop drinking, but it embedded in my mind for that 6 months later when I was ready to do something about myself, I went to him. I'll never forget it. November 8th, 1977. Appears to have been my last drink, though I'm not sure. It's early. I haven't had a drink for 20 years, 335 days, one day at a time. And I think back, how can I do that? Simple, I can. I can. We can. If you're new in this room, I can. We can. And my sponsor was right there, waiting on me, just waiting. I was his project. I knew he was going to get the AA Medal of Valor for me. frag for life. Yeah, I got Butler sobered up. He sat me down and said, I want to talk to you. And by the way, I went through treatment. It was getting cold. And I went through treatment, got drunk the night I left. And it's interesting. If you go through treatment, you want to do one of two things. Either go to college or be an alcoholism counselor. And I was going to do both. Barney says, let's put that on a shelf. Give me an AA year of your life, just 1 year. He says, because you're going to build a foundation upon which God is going to place a house with many rooms. And if that foundation is shaky, someday an emotional storm is going to come. And your foundation won't hold that storm, and it'll fall, and you'll have to drink to try to put it back together again. So give me 1 year. And I submit to you, I did. I did everything he asked me to do, and everything he did. I stood at doors shaking people's hand that I didn't want to shake. I talked to people I didn't want to talk to. I even made eye contact with them once in a while. I met those people at that convention, 3 weeks sober, and I didn't shoot none of them. I wanted to. Starting with Barney. And for a year I did the drill. I went to meetings early, stayed late. Went every day. Never missed a day for my first year. Never missed a day. Now I want to tell you what happened to me, and it could happen to you if you're new. Could happen to you if you're not new. Not new, need to be renewed. In my home group in Illinois, your sponsor comes up and gives a little spiel about you for your first year. Even if they have to lie. They don't want to hurt your feelings and send you back out. And then they sit down and I get up and I say something nice about him, if I don't forget. And an interesting thing happened to me. As I approached the podium after my sponsor sat down, I had this visual. It overwhelmingly came clear to me that I was the miracle. And then I saw Bill and Bob's picture on the wall, and I visualized mine floating up between them. And then I glanced down at my sponsor with 900 years of sobriety and thought, my God, is that all you are? Look at me after a year. And it was profoundly clear that I had outgrown him. So I did the only rational thing I could do. I fired him. I didn't tell him. Didn't figure he needed to know. And I sponsored myself. From my second to seventh year. Did steps 1, 12, and 13. By the way, ladies, if any of you here tonight are in your first year, I come up to you after this meeting tonight and say, and perhaps I'll posture a little. Maybe I'll even vacillate my voice. Hey. Would you like to go have coffee and talk about God? Run! So 7 years sober, I weigh 146 pounds. I've lost my teeth, I know not where. And because I have no program, I am now more depressed than I ever was drinking. And I don't have a sponsor to call because I've been lying. And so I make a decision all of my own. I call my psychiatrist. By the way, this ain't an opinion, so don't leave here and say I gave an opinion. I'm sharing my personal experience. I called my doctor, he called me in, gave me some tests, drew my blood, diagnosed me as being chemically imbalanced, said I had lithium, amitriptyline, and a new experimental chemical that was to become Prozac. He diagnosed me bipolar manic depressive. And then he asked me, since he knew I was in AA, if I had a sponsor in AA, and I said, yes, I do. I lied. He says, is your sponsor a doctor? I said, no. As a matter of fact, he's a sixth grade dropout that works at Farmall. He says, and he probably shouldn't tell you not to take this. I'm glad he told me that. I'm going to tell you why. He saved my life. Because had he not mentioned my sponsor, I would have never thought of it. So I called Barney up and said, I need to talk to you. So I met him in a restaurant, took my pills with me, sat down and said, Barney, I got problems. He said, I'm bipolar. He said, yeah. Oh, yeah, that and more. He says, one of these days you're going to be walking down 16th Street, dummy, and you're going to hear this loud explosion. It's going to be your head popping right out of your ass. And you won't be bipolar no more. Then he said, dummy, I'm not a doctor, but I do know this about you. You have no reason not to be depressed. He said, our natural state is depression and fear. And it has to get worse without a solution. And at that time, I didn't know what my solution was, so I didn't know how to comprehend that. He says, I'll make you a deal. Put the pills away for a while. He says, because I know you have never practiced AA as a way of life. He says, you do what I ask you to do for the next 2 years. And if it doesn't get better, I'll go with you. He tricked me is what he did. He took my pills. And I did exactly what he said. And guess what? He sent me out to California on a Greyhound bus and had me chat with a guy by the name of Clancy, who I had met 7 years earlier at that table. And he understood me. It became clear that someone else understood me. Not that other people didn't, but it became clear to me at that time. And I was set on a course of action in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came back to Illinois 6 months later, and I did the steps exactly the way they're outlined in the big book. I used a 12 and 12 for amplification of understanding. And by my 9th year of sobriety, my depression was gone. I didn't know, though. My sponsor had to tell me. Oh, you're doing better, brother. You sure? Now I want to tell you about why I have a sponsor. I have a disease of perception. Let me explain it to you. When I was new, my sponsor took me to Chicago to meetings because the police were looking for me in Moline. Little misunderstanding, bad break. And in that meeting I went to in Chicago, there's about 300 people, much the same size as this room. I think there's a few more here. But it was stadium seating, exactly the same as this. And my sponsor with all his old cronies were sitting in the front, you know, and they had us incurable ones in the second row. They didn't have to look at the spiritual disease. At least that was my opinion. And I was sitting next to my best friend, Jim. I'd known him 3 minutes. And there was a guy up here speaking, you know, lying, just like some of you think I am. At least that's what I was telling my best friend, Jim. And I looked at Jim and I said, Jim, how can AA in New York allow that man to come here and talk? He's lying. He couldn't have drank like that. His guts would have fallen out. A little while later, Jim, he couldn't have drank like that. He'd be in prison for the rest of his life. He couldn't have done that. A little while later, I said, Jimmy, he couldn't have done that. He'd be in the psych ward for the rest of his natural life. And I guess my sponsor got sick and tired of hearing me. He turned around in front of 300 people, looked me right in the eye, and he said, shut up, you goddamn loser. You ain't got a thing we want to hear. And if we ever think you do, we'll come out to that little car we found you in behind Harvey's restaurant. We'll toot your little horn and invite you in to share. Now, until that time, sit there, keep your mouth shut, or leave. That's what I heard him say. Come to find out later, here's what he really said. I hated his guts. I read something on page 15, paragraph 3 of the 12 and 12. It says AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature. Now remember, I am not one who believes I have a disease. I have to tell you that. I am one who believes I have what the big book says, a spiritual disease. That's a very important word. Because in my mind, if I have a disease, I'm a victim. If I have a spiritual disease, I own part of the problem. I can do something about it. That's important to me. I have a spiritual disease. And it says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink. So even for a retarded guy, I can figure that out. Okay? Practice AA, obsession expelled. Practice, you get the drift? And enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And I submit to you, that's all I've ever wanted in my life. Just to experience the feeling of happiness. To become a useful human being in the society of my peers. And to feel like a whole human being. I have never felt that way in my life. And I was going to succumb to drink again because I didn't know what the solution was, even though I was in the middle of it. And I got to tell you something. After I took those 12 steps, 2 years later, I weighed 242 pounds. I am a 40 waist, whereas before I was a 29. My hair started falling out. Not give and take thing. And I had a dream. Do I have 5 or 10 more minutes? Do I have time? Okay. I had a dream. Now, remember, I've been arrested twice for attempted murder. I've been in the psych ward 17 times. And I want to be a policeman. My sponsor told me I could do anything. And I knew I couldn't be a cop. But my sponsor said, you've got to try, because that'll be the greatest heartache of your life, is having not tried. He said, if you try for your dream and it doesn't come to pass, God didn't intend it to be. But you will never know if you don't try. God, I love my sponsor today. I applied for the Polk County Sheriff's Department in Des Moines, Iowa. And I had to fill out an application. I wanted to start lying right where it said name. Put down my brother's Social Security number. And during that 2-year period of time, I got my record expunged. We can do lots of things in AA that we don't believe we can do if we just stick to the task. And I filled out that application, and my sponsor and I both laughed that I would never get called in. I got called in. I took the physical agility test and did well. When you're doing, you know, when you're neurotic like me, you learn how to do neurobics. Stay in shape. All that thinking keeps the weight down. So I was ready for the test. But then I got scared because they said I had to take the MMPI. I took it and passed. And then came the interview. So I knew how to dress because my sponsor taught me. So I wore my lime green polyester shirt. That was a sight to behold. So I'm sitting there being interviewed. And there's this John Wayne sergeant type sitting over here staring at me. I don't like to be stared at. It bothers me. And they're asking me questions, and this board of supervisors says to me, Mr. Butler says here you're an alcoholic. I said, yes, sir, I am. Says you've been sober 9 years. I said, yes, sir, I have. He says, well, we talked about that, and we came to the collective opinion that means you're probably cured. Is that right? Well, that creates a problem. Because I want to tell the truth, but I can't leave to call my sponsor to check it out, and I'm afraid if I say, well, let me explain something to you, sir. What I have is a daily reprieve, contingent upon the maintenance growth of my spiritual condition. If I fail to maintain my spiritual condition, I could drink tomorrow. Could I have my gun? So I said, okay. And then this sergeant gives up and starts getting in my face. And you all know what it's like to have a sponsor in your face. Well, some of you do. He gets in my face and he starts jabbing me in the chest. And he says this, quote, "Listen, dummy. You think you could kill somebody if they was trying to kill you?" And I looked at him and I thought, I probably could if I had to. And I'm silently hoping it's you. Then he started to walk away and he turned around and shot right back in my face. He said, "Well, listen, stupid." I said, "Dummy's one thing, stupid's another." He says, "You think you could kill someone if they was trying to kill me?" And I shot out of my chair, got that far from his face, and I said, "I doubt it a lot." It was at that point in time I thought, oh yeah, the Serenity Prayer. I sat down, knew I blew it, and they dismissed me. I knew I blew it. I got called back in to be told I was going to the academy. And guess who my trainer was in the academy? Oh, it got ugly. That was the ugliest 16 weeks other than my first 16 weeks of sponsorship. I came out of the academy fourth in my class. And I missed Top Gun by one round. They classified me a combat expert marksman. My sponsor found that interesting. I called Barney long distance and I said, "Barney, I passed. I made it. I'm out. I'm going to graduate. Will you come to my graduation?" I heard my sponsor cry. And he said, "I'd be proud to come." And he did. But first I told him over the phone, I said, "Barney, they gave me my gun." I heard my sponsor say, "Oh, shit." And I did that for 5 years, moved to California because I've always wanted to live in California. And, you know, we patched the family back together as best we could. I did the steps. I did 8 and 9 and cleared up the wreckage of my past. And I had dreams and hopes. And AA has allowed me to fulfill every dream and hope I've got. Though my hopes and dreams were small, I was able to fulfill them. And it don't matter how big the dream is. Make them reachable. And AA allowed me to work my butt off. And it's all come through working with other alcoholics. It's all been through sponsorship. Clancy's my sponsor now, and I got him because he understands me. I live in California, and I want him to be my sponsor. And he gives me excellent direction. And for him to ask me to come in his stead is a very flattering and humbling thing for me. Because it was almost 21 years ago I sat in that huddle thinking I was never going to be good enough to be with him. And here I am, good enough to be with you. What's that tell you? There's a lot of disease in this world. I love AA. Did I mention that? Newcomer, it's this simple. We just submit, commit, and surrender ourselves absolutely. Now, what makes me an alcoholic? Very briefly, I'll tell you. I had no idea. When I drink alcohol, it performs an illusionary sensation of seeming normalcy. That's the effect produced. When I feel like I don't fit in, I don't belong, I'm not a part of, my mind recalls that somewhere between 4 and 5 Budweisers, I fit in. I have to have a sufficient substitute for that or I'm going to drink again someday. Because I could walk into a meeting and feel like I don't fit in. That's why my sponsor had me do all them jobs. See, in the 12 and 12, it says, when I do a fifth step and hear one, I have a strong sense of belonging comes. I begin to feel like I fit in, I belong, I'm a part of. You see, what I do in the pyramid of Alcoholics Anonymous arrests a condition known as alcoholism. And it's that simple. And that's why I'm still here. I'll guarantee you, knowing Bob, I know that's why Bob's still here. I know that's why Coenga's still here. It's because I'm of service to other alcoholics. And I want to stay in service to alcoholics because it's allowed me to become a free human being. It's allowed me to do things that I can't even imagine I'm doing. If you're new in this room, if you don't even have a dream, the fact that I get to walk the streets a free man and be a citizen is enough. But God wants more from me if I'm willing to work for it and accept it and have it. To get to be here with you this weekend is a joy that I'll talk about for a long time. I want to thank you for inviting me to come with you tonight, for allowing me to take my sponsor's position here and try to be a sufficient substitute. And newcomer, this is how easy it is to start. It's hokey, so you got to hang with me. If I keep this hand here locked in the loving hand of my Father God, and I keep this hand in my sponsor's hand, your hand, the hand of those I sponsor, I've got no hands free to pick up a drink. Thank you.